If your vibe is the earlier the better, Lowe's early Black Friday deals are a no-brainer. Get up to 35% off select major appliances, and rewards members get free delivery, haul-away, basic installation, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 11/4. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change. LG member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
Everything you think you know about women in America's Wild West is wrong. I feel like we've been convinced that women back then were just quietly knitting, churning butter, and popping out kids left and right, Little House on the Prairie style. But there's so much more to the story. Growing up as a kid, I watched the movie Calamity Jane, like every single day. The one with Doris Day? I watched it because my babysitter had all these old movies, and me and my sister would watch Calamity Jane specifically over and over again. Calamity Jane was a musical, so it was a good time. I mean, the costumes, the hair, the beauty, it was just so fun. I loved it. But recently, I started wondering, what's the truth behind Calamity Jane? I mean, was she even real? Turns out, in the late 1800s, there were a bunch of women making a name for themselves in the Wild West. They were rough, they were tough, and they were smart and rebellious. And their legacies are just as complex as the cowboys we always hear about. Today I'm talking about Calamity Jane, Annie Oakley, and a woman named Belle Starr. Who were they? What did they do? And why did they do it? Well, friends, I dug deep and found some answers for us. So today, let's dig into some famous women of the Wild West. Yeehaw! Yeah! Friends, I hope you're having a wonderful day today. My name is Bailey Sarian, and I like to welcome you to my podcast, Dark History. Here, we believe history doesn't have to be boring. I mean, it might be tragic, sometimes it's happy, but either way, it's our dark history. Before we get into today's story, don't forget to like and subscribe, because I come to you with that hot, juicy history goss every week. And also, you can leave a comment down below, because I love hearing from you in the comments section. Now, let's get into it. So, let's start off with a total icon from the Wild West. She was a national sensation, even when she was alive. That's because her name became associated with wild tales of adventure. I'm talking about Calamity Jane. Here's the thing, I thought calamity was like an STD. Apparently, it's another word for disaster. And her reputation was more of like a PR move invented by Jane herself. So why did Jane the Disaster leave such a mark on American history? On May 1st, 1852, Martha Jane Canary was born in Princeton, Missouri. She was the oldest of six kids, and there's not a lot known about Martha's mom, but it was known around town that her dad had a pretty bad gambling problem, which is never a good thing, especially when you have six kids to feed, but it happens, I guess. Martha's childhood is pretty much a black hole of information. There's just not a ton there, but we do know that when Martha was 13, she and her family packed their stuff and left town. In 1865, the Canary family made their way west. And during their 5-month journey across the country, Martha fell in love with hunting animals and going on little adventures. And this taught her a few things. I know, a 5-month journey? It's like the Oregon Trail. Martha said herself, quote, "By the time we reached Virginia City, I was considered a remarkable good shot and a fearless rider for a girl of my age," end quote. This must have been frustrating, or it was helpful. Like, Martha, make us another raccoon hat. You know, it's cold up in here. Anyway, the family arrived in Virginia City, Montana, but over the next year, life as Martha knew it completely changed. In 1866, Martha's mother passed away from pneumonia, and a few months after that, her dad also died. So at 14 years old, Martha was forced to grow up real quick. She became the head of the household, taking care of her 5 younger siblings, and she had to figure out how to make money fast. Martha moved the family to a place called Piedmont, Wyoming, and to make ends meet, she took on a job as a cook, a dance hall girl, a dishwasher, and even a nurse. Wow, I know. She did it all. Then around 1869, she found a job as a sex worker at Fort Laramie. Now, sex work was big business back in the Wild West, especially in a place like Fort Laramie. I mean, it was a stop on the Oregon Trail, and it was a military location, so there was lots of men coming and going. Sex work was allegedly one of the more lucrative jobs Martha could have, and instead of being chained to a husband, forced to do housework for no money, sex workers had more say in their freedom. Yes, of course, there were big risks, but some experts think Martha could have been empowered by this freedom. As Martha got older, she became a tall woman with a, quote, masculine build. And she realized that she actually could take advantage of this. Dressing as a man allowed her to work in places that didn't hire women and do work that she actually wanted to do. Not only this, it also helped her live a life with more adventure. In 1872, at 20 years old, Martha joined the Army as a scout, which was a job only men could hold at the time. Martha was able to get away with this because she was, quote, disguised by male clothing and also worked under a fake name. It was at this time that Martha earned the nickname she became famous for, Calamity Jane. Now, here's the story according to Martha. When she was in the Army, she and her squadron were sent out to stop a Native American uprising. They were out in battle for several days, and a few soldiers were killed along the way. Now, at one point, Martha and the guys were ambushed. They all climbed onto their horses to get the hell away. But Martha saw that her captain had been shot, and he was losing consciousness and was about to fall off his horse. So Martha turned her horse around and galloped back to her captain as fast as she could. She was like dodging enemy fire the whole way. So she got there just in time to catch her captain before he fell to the ground. She then lifted him onto her horse and then rode away to safety. While he was recovering back at the fort, her captain allegedly said, "I name you Calamity Jane, the heroine of the plains." Now, this is a story that Calamity told. Now, others believe she got the nickname because she would warn men that they would court calamity if they offended her. She was essentially threatening to ruin them if they bothered her. So I kind of love that too. Unfortunately, Martha was fired from the Army when they discovered that she was in fact not a man. You know, it's like Mulan, kind of. And when the media finds out that she's a woman, that's when they started creating wild stories about her. And she's like, yeah, I did that. And she starts to like lean into this Calamity Jane persona. Karen R. Jones, author of The Many Lives of Calamity, said Martha was well known in the, quote, rough and ready settlements of the Western Plains for dressing in men's clothes, a taste for liquor and wanderlust, and a tendency to shoot off her mouth and her guns. I'll tell you what, Calamity Jane sounds like a good time, am I right? By 1876, America was about to fall in love with Calamity Jane. That year, she moved to Deadwood, South Dakota. This would become the place she called home for the rest of her life. People were striking gold around Deadwood, so Calamity found work there driving big wagons and hauling equipment to mining camps. Local news reporters who were covering the gold strikes lost their minds when they saw Calamity. I mean, here was this tall woman dressed like a man and doing work for a man. Like, this was very shocking at the time. One journalist who met her said she, quote, has the daring and courage of the lion or the devil himself. So these reporters started publishing accounts of Calamity Jane in the paper, and people loved the stories about her. And then a writer named Horatio N. McGuire wrote a booklet called The Black Hills and American Wonderland. In this booklet, he wrote a vivid account of this wild woman of the West, and it launched Calamity Jane to national fame. So her story was for sure exaggerated and sensational, but like, people don't care, you know? I mean, this woman was real, and she was as daring as a devil, and that's all that mattered. Calamity Jane really enjoyed this newfound fame. In fact, she started to add her own stories to the tall tales of Calamity Jane. And at one point, she said that she was a rider for the Pony Express, which was an early version of the U.S. Postal Service. Calamity said tons of riders before her got held up at gunpoint and robbed of, like, the packages and money they carried, but not her. She said, quote, "My reputation as a rider and quick shot was well known, and they knew I never missed my mark." She even claimed that she was an Army scout for General Custer in Arizona back in 1871. And this caught people's attention because Custer was a famous American Army general during the Civil War. And during these travels with Custer, Calamity said that she had tons of dangerous missions to perform. And she survived all of it because she said, quote, "I was considered the most reckless and daring rider and one of the best shots in the Western country." Sounds great. But the problem is, in 1871, General Custer was never in Arizona, and neither was Calamity. Oops. But the tall tales only got taller, and Calamity's reputation became larger than life. She liked to make her presence known wherever she went, and apparently one of her favorite things to do was to get drunk and shoot up a saloon. I mean, what else are you gonna do back then? Shit, you know? One man who knew Calamity Jane personally said she was, quote, "drunken, disorderly, and wholly devoid of any conception of morality." At the same time, she was known to be generous and kind-hearted. Like, there was a smallpox epidemic in Deadwood, and while most of the town wanted nothing to do with the sick people, Calamity Jane spent time nursing and comforting them. Then, in June of 1876, she met a man named Wild Bill Hickok, while they were traveling in the same wagon train. Now, Wild Bill here is a character who could have his own story, but he was a soldier, a lawman, and a gunslinger, a gambler, an actor, and was involved in, like, tons of gunfights. He liked to exaggerate stories about himself almost as much as he loved drinking heavily. I mean, just like Calamity. And when these two met, I guess they just hit it off. It was like they were made for each other. Between the partying, the national attention, and their reputations, they could relate to each other on, like, a different level. So for about 2 months, they became very close. So close that some believe they were making sexuals. And what happened next completely changed the course of Calamity Jane's life. So Wild Bill Hickok was murdered on August 2nd, 1876. He was shot in the back of the head while playing poker. And if the rumors of their romance are true, it makes sense why Calamity was totally devastated when Wild Bill was killed. I guess she was actually there when it happened. Calamity Jane said she went after the killer with a meat cleaver because she left her guns at home, but I guess the guy eventually got away. Calamity was depressed after Wild Bill's death. She felt like there was nothing left for her in Deadwood. So she hit the road and spent the next decade living on the frontier and, like, shacking up with a few different cowboys, I guess. In the late 1880s, Calamity returned once again to Deadwood. And this time she had a small child with her and she told people it was her daughter. But I guess they didn't have a dime to their name. So the town put together a little fundraiser to help send Calamity's daughter to a Catholic boarding school. Turns out the fundraiser was a success. I don't know how much money they raised, but what I do know is that Calamity took that money, she went, she got drunk, and then spent the most of it that same night. She's like, "F that baby." You know? I guess then she skipped town and just really living up to that Calamity nickname. And to be honest, Calamity's best years were behind her. Her popularity was fading. After drinking binges, she started doing crazy things to get public attention, like riding a bull down Main Street in a town called Rapid City. By the 1890s, the Gilded Age was in full swing, but people still had, like, some nostalgia for those lawless days of cowboys, gunslingers, and gamblers. So Wild West-themed shows popped up, and Calamity had a bit of resurgence as a performer. In 1893, she appeared as a storyteller in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. I know, that's a real show. I thought it was just at Disneyland. Have you been? I've never been inside, actually. But I always see it. And then I keep on walking. But she was a part of it, great. Calamity did go on to write an autobiography about her life. She called it Life and Adventures of Calamity Jane. And there's some truth in it. But some historians say that most of the stories Calamity wrote in there are completely made up. I don't think it matters, really. I mean, she was just giving the people what they wanted. And they wanted Calamity Jane, not Martha Canary. After her years of hard living and heavy drinking, Calamity Jane died on August 1st, 1903. And it's believed that she died from complications of alcoholism. I mean, despite all her success in life, she died without a penny to her name. Even still, her funeral was held in Deadwood, and it was jam-packed. After several hundred people viewed her body, they buried Calamity Jane right next to Wild Bill Hickok. Aw, so sweet. And even in death, Calamity Jane's story doesn't end, because there's one final twist no one saw coming. Was it a musical? No, that comes later. But when Calamity Jane died, one of the few possessions she allegedly had left was a bunch of unsent letters. They were in a bundle and some were addressed to a person named Jean. Then in 1941, Jean McCormick came forward and claimed that these letters were addressed to her. And Jean claimed that these letters proved she was a love child of Calamity Jane and Wild Bill. So, whether all the stories are true or not, Calamity Jane really did live up to her nickname. I mean, she really set the tone for what the Wild West was like back in the day. And she blazed a trail for our next Wild West lady, Annie Oakley. In fact, Calamity Jane and Annie spent some time together in those Buffalo Bill Wild West shows I mentioned earlier. Crossover, it's great. Annie Oakley, have you heard of her? You probably have, maybe you haven't, but let me tell you. Annie Oakley was born on August 13th, 1860 in Ohio. And Annie's early years were no walk in the park. I mean, you try being born in the 1800s. Her dad passed away when she was just 6 years old, leaving her mom alone with six kids to look after. Oh my God, like Calamity. The family finances were always like extremely tight, and Annie's mom remarried and had another baby, but then this husband also died a year or two later. So now Annie's mom was back on her own with six kids and a newborn. So when she was about eight, Annie went to live at a house for orphans, the elderly, and the mentally ill. This sounds rough, but it actually gave Annie the chance to get an education. While she was there, she would learn to sew, which would help her out later in her life. When she was about 13, Annie went back to live with her mother and siblings. And by now, her mom was on her third husband. So the family finances, I guess, were a little bit more stable, but they were still very poor. Annie would take her dad's old Kentucky rifle out and hunt for rabbits and birds. And she got pretty good at it. I mean, to the point where she was hunting small animals for the local grocery store. The animals Annie shot were then resold to hotels and restaurants all the way over in Cincinnati. Now, this eventually made Annie enough money to be able to pay the $200 mortgage on her mom's house when she was just 15. Annie was just naturally gifted at shooting. And she apparently said, quote, "When it felt right, I just pulled the trigger." Wow. Yeah. So Annie is making some good money. So she decides to enter into a shooting competition in Cincinnati. And while she's there, she goes up against this guy named Frank E. Butler. Frank was, I guess, like a pretty big deal. He was a marksman who performed in a lot of Wild West variety shows. It's kind of like the circus, but with guns and cowboys. Anyway, during the competition, Annie hits all 25 targets. And Frank, he missed one, which made Annie the winner. Frank was so impressed that he ended up asking her out and they started dating. And the next year, in 1876, they got married. Aw. Annie and Frank start touring around the country, performing in shows and shooting all kinds of things. And at first, Annie just acted as Frank's assistant. I know, even though she was technically the better shooter. But then Frank's partner gets sick. So Annie steps in and finally gets her time in the spotlight. From the moment Annie joined Frank's act and started performing next to him in the vaudeville circuit, people just loved her. She was known for being kind, professional, humble, and honestly, insanely talented with a gun. She even got the nickname Little Sure Shot from Sitting Bull, who was a legendary Native American tribal leader. Annie set herself apart from the rest of the other female shooters at the time. So instead of wearing skimpy, flashy outfits, which was the norm, Annie dressed pretty conservatively and made all of her own costumes. Annie said this was because she didn't want anything to distract from her shooting skills. These outfits didn't show much skin, but they were really cute. Cowgirl chic. Okay, so in 1884, Annie starts touring with Frank in the Sells Brothers Circus. After a year, they get an amazing offer to join the biggest show at the time, Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show. Now, this was huge. Buffalo Bill was the number one marksman at the time, and his show toured all over the world and in front of like important people, like celebrities and even like the president. It was so popular that in 1893 alone, 3 million people went to the spectacle. In the Buffalo Bill show, Frank and Annie started out as performing partners. But as more people see just how talented Annie is, her fame starts to take over. Now, thankfully, like rarely do you hear this, but Annie's husband, Frank, wasn't threatened by this. He sees how talented she is. I mean, that's why he asked her out in the first place. So he takes a step back and decides to become Annie's manager slash assistant. So supportive. Love to see that, huh? And overnight, Annie becomes the star of the Buffalo Bill show. It was her name on the posters, advertised as champion markswoman. Basically, Frank would only come on stage so Annie could shoot cigarettes out of his mouth. Yeah, that's love right there. Annie also shot glass balls out of the air, and she could split a playing card in half, like the skinny half, like paper thin, from over 30 feet away. She could also snuff out candles with the wind from her bullets and shoot the corks off of wine bottles. Hot. Annie performed her stunts in Spain, Italy, France, and even for Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee in England. Apparently, the queen called Annie, quote, a very clever little girl. Okay, thanks. Like, way to downplay it. Very clever little girl. All right, cool. And everywhere Annie went, she proved that women were totally capable of not only handling firearms, but outshooting men. She was really passionate about encouraging women to learn how to use pistols, which were smaller and could be kept in their purses for self-defense. Annie once said, quote, I would like to see every woman know how to handle guns as naturally as they know how to handle babies, end quote. Annie spent 17 years with the Buffalo Bill show before she retired in 1901. And then something wild happened. Annie found herself in an insane legal battle. A Chicago newspaper reported that Annie Oakley had been arrested for stealing a man's pants to sell them and buy cocaine. Because this one newspaper printed it, I guess a whole bunch of other newspapers picked up the story and printed it too. But the thing was, the story was literally fake. Annie didn't do drugs, and she definitely wasn't stealing pants. And also, the story couldn't have been true because she and Frank were living in New Jersey at the time and not Chicago. So she was like, you know what? I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Now, it turned out that someone had, in fact, stolen a man's pants and sold them for cocaine. Wild times, huh? But that person was a woman named Maud Fontanella. When Maud was arrested, she told the officers her name was Annie Oakley, but she spelled Annie A-N-Y. I guess she couldn't spell. But it's kind of amazing. I mean, I guess you could get away with anything before you had to carry a government ID with a picture on it, you know? The real Annie Oakley was pissed at all these newspapers for dragging her good name through the mud. So she decides to sue every paper that printed that fake story. And over the next 7 years, she does just that. She successfully sues 54 newspapers and wins. Go off, queen. Woo! When World War I broke out, Annie wanted to do her part. So she reaches out to the Secretary of War and offers to fully fund and train a troop of all-women fighters. She even offered to teach soldiers like how to accurately shoot. But both of these offers were declined. I know, why, right? Like, they think they're better than Annie Oakley? Because she's a woman, you know, who gets her period. She don't know war. Now, at this point, Annie was almost 60, but she still wasn't an incredible shooter. She and Frank worked at the Pinehurst Gun Club giving shooting lessons. And sometimes they would even give little demonstrations. I know, could you imagine getting trained by Annie Oakley? On March 5th, 1922, Annie hit 98 out of 100 clay targets from 16 yards away. Some sources say that she actually hit all 100 targets. Now, this not only broke all existing trap shooting records, but it also proved that at the age of 62, Annie was still one of the best shooters in the world. So honestly, it's our loss that they didn't let her help out with the war. And then Annie Oakley went on to make sunglasses. I'm just kidding. Oakley sunglasses? Great. Annie Oakley passed away in 1926. And a few weeks later, Frank, her husband, passed away too. I mean, at this point, they had been married for 50 years. So sad. So sad. Okay. Annie left behind an incredible legacy. I mean, she paved the way for female shooters, female self-defense, and advocated for women to learn a skill that was mostly dominated by men. Annie actually made more than any other sharpshooter, except for Buffalo Bill himself. Wow, incredible. She was great, wow. Good for her. Now, the last Wild West queen I wanted to talk about is someone you did not want to mess with. A lot of Wild West characters are kind of all talk, you know, but she was the opposite. She was one of the most dangerous criminals in Texas. She hid fugitives, robbed banks, cheated, stole, and did it all in a dress while riding side saddle. This is the true life of Belle Starr. Belle was born Myra Maybelle Shirley on February 5th, 1848 in Missouri. Now, she was born into like a pretty successful family. Her father was a farmer who actually made a big profit because his farm raised hogs, horses, and like tons of different crops. But after a while, her father, I guess, got sick of the farm life. It was kind of boring. So the family sold their farm and moved to a town called Carthage. Her father used the profits from the farm to open a hotel slash tavern. And that was so successful, they opened up a blacksmith shop as well. And before you know it, the family businesses ended up taking up like the whole block. So you could say Belle was born with a silver spoon in her mouth. It's been said many times that she loved to flaunt that she was the rich girl in town. And she always had like a posse of people around her. I'm picturing Kate from Lizzie McGuire. Remember her? That's what she's giving me. She was described as well-loved and spoiled rotten. And she went to like this all-female private school and she killed it when it came to her schoolwork. I mean, she was smart. But also Belle had edge. One of her classmates gave an interview about her saying, quote, "Would fight anyone, boy or girl." At home, Belle had four brothers, so you know she had to learn how to fight. It was said she was very close with her older brother who went by Bud. He made a point to teach her how to shoot guns, ride horses, and defend herself. Because of this, Belle became a master sharpshooter and horse rider. So her life was just peaches and cream. I mean, she was daddy's little princess until the Civil War broke out. There was a lot of fighting near her hometown over the war, and it was dividing families and neighbors, and everyone hated each other. Plus, different armies were coming into town, taking over and like wrecking all of the businesses, and it was tense. Her brother Bud became something called a bushwhacker. I know, which is not a creep hanging out in the bush jacking off. No, nay, nay. Instead, it meant that he hid out in the countryside, just waiting in a bush so he could shoot at people trying to take over the town. Bushwhacker. Yeah. He was known to shoot at, harass, rob, and even murder people. Even though Belle was just a teenager, rumor has it that she was actually a spy for the bushwhackers. Quote, Bell allegedly volunteered to spy on the troops through her social circles and returned the information to her brother. Rebels rode into town and burned everything to the ground. And by 1864, the war had totally destroyed her hometown and everything her family had built. Her family and community were torn apart. And then the worst thing possible happened to Bell. Yes. Her brother Bud was shot and killed by federal troops. Now this totally broke her. Now the day of Bud's death, Bell vowed to get her revenge for her brother. Now we don't know exactly what she was going after, but we do know that this tragedy completely shaped her personality. Her family packed up the few belongings they had and took the long ride to Texas. They spent months on the trail. I mean, it was rough. At the same time, a bunch of Bud's old friends rode into town, and they were part of a gang called the James Younger Gang. Okay, so this gang, they robbed a bank, and they needed somewhere to hide. They knew that they could count on Bell since she was allegedly a spy for their side. Maybe it's because they reminded Bell of her brother, or maybe it's because she was a secret bad girl. Bell started to hang out around bank robbers and criminals after this. She once said, quote, I am a friend to any brave and gallant outlaw. I mean, they were her people. Bell reconnected with an old friend from back home. His name was Jim Reed. So Jim was a bad boy. He was known for robbing banks, and Bell was into that. The two of them actually had a kid together, a little girl named Rosie Lee. So he tried to clean up his act for the sake of his family. But you know, the normal life, it wasn't working for Jim. He and Bell were strapped for cash, but he knew if he robbed a bank, they'd be set. So he robbed a bank. But once Jim resumed that outlaw lifestyle, he just like couldn't stop. He just kept doing illegal stuff. I mean, Jim even murdered a man during one of his crime sprees. So he, Bell, and their little daughter had to flee to California. In California, Bell gave birth to their second child, a boy named Eddie. And even though there were now two young children running around, Jim took his criminal activities to the next level. And Bell decided she was going to become an outlaw too. Jim joined several gangs, and one of those was the Star Clan. This is when Bell allegedly got very involved in these criminal activities. Apparently, in 1873, Jim and Bell snuck onto the property of the Graysons, who were like farmers nearby. They knew the farmers had $30,000 in gold coins, and it was just theirs for the taking. Now, rumor has it that Bell was dressed as a male cowboy so they wouldn't recognize her. They break onto the property and attack the Graysons. She and Jim tortured them by hanging them from a tree for hours until they gave up the secret location of the coins. And I guess now Bell was addicted to that crime life. She's like, oh my God, that was so fun. Because the very next year, she robs a stagecoach, which, you know what that is, no? It's one of those old wagony cars that they used to ride in the Victorian era. Yeah, she robs that shit. Now, Bell needed to be more careful because there was like a warrant out for her arrest. But here's the thing. She didn't really give a shit. She knew she could outshoot anyone who came near her. But the same couldn't be said about Jim. In 1874, Jim was shot dead by the authorities. I mean, just like Bell's brother. So she's like, no, you know, no. Bell found herself a widow with two children and a warrant for her arrest. So she turned to someone she knew, one of Jim's friends, Sam Starr. And he was a member of the Star Clan. So the two, I guess they fall in love, maybe they don't, but they end up getting married. And this is where she gets her iconic last name. Since Sam was Cherokee, they lived together on Cherokee land. This meant the authorities were not allowed to mess with them because Cherokee land laws trumped the local law. So Bell and Sam used this to their advantage. They would take in any outlaws who needed a place to lay low until, like, he got off of them. The two of them were very well known in the outlaw community. They would also commit all these crimes in town and then race back home, knowing that they could hide out from the authorities. And apparently the two of them had this whole operation going. Belle would lace herself into one of those sexy little Wild West dresses, and she would jump on a horse, and she would ride into town, you know. And apparently Belle was hot, okay? She was a babe. So she'd ride up to a man, side saddle, and pretend to be this, like, gorgeous little damsel in distress. She's like, oh my God, officer, I don't know how to use this gun. It's just so heavy. How can I use it to protect myself, officer? Oh, I dropped my gun. I'm so silly. You know, she knew what she was doing. Now, while she was doing this, Sam Starr and his gang would be robbing the men blind. Yeah, they'd take their money, their horses, and honestly, anything they could get their hands on. While Belle was playing dumb. I love it. Oh, I just like don't know what I'm doing. It's so crazy. I'm on a horse. I thought this was a donkey. That's so crazy. I like just don't know. It's so hot, huh? So they would rob, right? And she'd be like, oh, yeah, that's so crazy. And then she'd speed off, still like riding side saddle, holding her gun perfectly. And then the men would realize that this was a freaking act. They're like, oh, fuck. I mean, I was impressed. Side saddle? Have you seen Princess Diaries 2? You know how hard riding side saddle is? Good for her. So she became known as the Bandit Queen because she'd steal people's stuff before they even knew what hit them. She knew how to talk her way out of trouble or pay off the right people to get her friends off the hook. Now, Belle did this for years without breaking a sweat. But, you know, one day she ran out of luck. A local judge found out about Belle and Sam's little crime scheme, and she and Sam were sentenced to a year in prison. A whole year. There were 19 other convicts serving time in this jail, and Belle was the only woman. After 9 months, the judge let Sam and Belle out for good behavior, saying he hoped they would, quote, decide to become decent citizens. And of course, they were like, oh my God, yeah. We won't do anything anymore. Pinky swear. But they immediately went back to the same old stuff. She and Sam went back to stealing horses, and they even started blackmailing people for money. Belle was arrested several times after her prison sentence, but never convicted of anything more. She always managed to get away with it. But then, in 1886, tragedy struck again. Sam was killed in a gunfight. Damn. So Belle was like, you know what? Third time's a charm, right? So she marries Sam's brother, Bill July. What a name. These people, right? Sam Starr? Bill July? The fuck is going on? After this, she was said to, I guess, calm down a bit. I mean, she was getting older, and all that crime was just, like, exhausting. Or maybe her boobs started to sag. We don't know. But when she turned 40 in 1888, she made an announcement, essentially saying outlaws were no longer allowed on her property. I mean, they were bringing too much trouble, and she just wanted a soft life. She was ready to live the rest of her life peacefully without any trouble from the law. But then on February 3rd, 1889, it all came to an end. Belle was riding into town so she could pick up a few things from the store, when suddenly, gunshots rang out. Belle was shot from behind in the back, neck, shoulder, and face. And then, you know, her horse freaked out from the noise, right? So Belle was like thrown to the ground. Just drama. Not long after, Belle was found dead. She bled out from her wounds on the side of the road. Because Belle had beef with so many people, they never like figured out who did it. People thought maybe it was a former lover, an outlaw she pissed off, or maybe even her own son. What? Yeah. Apparently they had been feuding. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she pissed off a lot of people, so it really could have been anyone. I mean, her killer was never identified. And in the years after her death, her legend just grew and grew because so little was actually known about her. She was a very private outlaw. I mean, she didn't brag like so many of the men she worked with. In fact, she only ever talked about herself publicly a few times, despite being like a local legend. She once said, quote, "I regard myself as a woman who has seen much of life." Wow. And I think that sums her up perfectly. And honestly, all of the other women too. I mean, they've been through some stuff. The whole reason I wanted to do this episode was to learn about women in the Wild West, you know? Because we usually see them in shows and movies as these sad, quiet wives waiting for their husbands to come home from the frontier. Or it's a musical, like Calamity Jane, that makes the whole Wild West era look way more fun than it actually was. I just wanted to know, you know, some truth about some badass women. And after learning about these three women, I keep thinking to myself, who else is out there? You know? If you know of any cutthroat Wild West women I missed, let me know in the comments section down below. Now, speaking of uncovering the truth behind famous stories, baby girl Lisa, listen. Listen, you are going to flip. Because next week, I'm bringing back a dark history favorite, an episode that examines the stories and films that defined our childhood. Now, these stories seem innocent at first, wholesome even, but the true story is much, much darker, weirder, and just plain horrifying. We'll be talking about the true stories behind Rapunzel, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, and Alice in Wonderland. So I'll see you next week for The Dark History of Disney, Part 2. Woo! Well, friends, thank you for hanging out with me today. You can join me over on my YouTube where you can watch these episodes on Thursday after the podcast airs. And while you're there, you can also catch my murder, mystery, and makeup. And don't forget to like and subscribe and comment down below because I'd love to hear your guys' reactions to today's story. Now, let's read a couple of comments that you guys have left me. Bubbles, Easy Blonde, great name, left us a comment saying, Joan Crawford rules. So glad Joan and Paul are helping with the sponsor blurbs. Yeah, okay, I thought that you were just gonna give credit to Joan and not me, because I was like, oh my gosh, she doesn't even do anything. But yes, I know, finally these two are pitching in and getting to work, right? Great job, you guys. Great job. Desolate One left a comment on our postal service episode saying, quote, I'm a letter carrier. Sure, we don't deliver babies anymore, but we'll deliver cremated remains all day long. Oh, God. I never thought about that. That's so sad. All I have to say is thank you for your service. You're doing great work out there. Well, that's dark. Haley Sargent, 7122, said, I am obsessed with you. Oh my God, thanks. And your positive spin on dark things. Can you do an episode on the London Bridge? You touched on it years ago with creepy nursery rhymes, and I must know more. I love that Fergie song. Remember? No, I'm just kidding. Thank you, Haley. That was so sweet. You know, one time I went to London and like I thought the London Bridge was the cute one with all the lights and stuff. And then I posted it on my Instagram story and everyone's like, you idiot. That's not the London Bridge. Turn around. And I turned around and it's like this ugly brick bridge. And I was like, that's the London Bridge? Yeah. It's like that Fergie song really lied to me. But I would like to know the history of the London Bridge. I think that's a good idea. And why is there's like a London Bridge in, is it like Arizona or something? What is that about? Why is it there? Okay, I got questions, which means you're onto something. Thank you for the recommendation. I'm gonna go listen to Fergie. I love you guys for watching and also for commenting. Keep on commenting, bring them on because maybe you'll be featured, maybe. And hey, if you don't know, Dark History is an Audio Boom original. A special thank you to our expert, Dr. Sue Matheson, professor at University College of the North in Manitoba, Canada, specialized in the Wild West and the Western. And I'm your host, Bailey Sarian. I hope you have a good rest of your day. You make good choices. And I'll be talking to you next week. Goodbye.